You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Since we started Monster Talk, there's been many topics we've not gotten around to that are directly monster related. I suppose some of this is because of time constraints, but a lot of it's because I just tend to sort of follow my own interests without giving it a lot of thought. But there's many monsters around the world that I still want us to cover, and some of those are right here in the United States. So I plan to do some episodes on Native American monsters. We'll be taking a deeper look at Native American culture and monster overlap in episodes discussing the skinwalker, the wendigo, and some of the more interesting ways that Native American folklore has been tied into Bigfoot culture. We were contacted by the Seneca Nation Museum, which just moved into a huge new facility, and Tribal Representative David Shango offered to talk to us about Seneca culture and some of its beliefs, including some monsters that will probably sound familiar. I'm admittedly very ignorant about much of Native American culture across many tribes, so hopefully as David clears up some of my ignorance, it'll be informative to you guys too. I know I learned a lot, but this episode is not very heavy on skepticism. I didn't ask David on to argue about what's literally true or not, but more to hear about his tribe's stories. Some of what we talk about today will be covered in some upcoming episodes in more critical depth, but I want to thank David for his time and stories, and if you find yourself in New York State near Salamanca, check out the museum. Links to some books, some online Seneca information, and the museum will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org.
Monster Talk. Monster Talk.
So, David, welcome to the show. And we're hoping that you can just tell us a little bit about yourself to begin with.
I was kind of going to go this way and get when he's a date. David Nate Garso, going on cut. Hawaiian D and E gar, so I'm going away car. I get gay got oh here no took no gate.
I'm betting that's not English, but
no, that's our native language. I'm glad y'all are here, and David is my English name. Hawaiian D is my Indian name. The ha part means like I'm sort of insight over there, and the Y and D means like they know him or they're familiar with him. My clan is Beaver and that I'm from Ohio or for Allegheny Territory. So
fantastic.
It's usually how we introduce each when we formally introduce people to ourselves in our own language. So because a lot of people don't think that we still have our language, but we do.
That's awesome.
Actually, my daughter spoke Seneca first and then English. So.
Oh, brilliant. And how many speakers of the language are there at the moment?
There's hundreds of different native languages. I mean, you hear about, you know, like World War II, you know, most of the Navajos are famous for their code talkers, but our people were more in Germany and they would talk to each other in our own language. Some people think that, you know, Indian languages are the same, but they're not.
No.
Yeah. And, like, I have no idea how to speak Navajo. They're way in the desert. We're way up here in the Northeast with trees and all that. So totally different environment, totally different languages.
Yeah, I think it's like Australian Aboriginal languages. There are about 200 of them. So there's no one Aboriginal language.
Yeah, my ignorance about Native Americans in general is vast and embarrassing. I'm hoping that maybe you can help me clear up some of that today. And I imagine that a lot of our listeners don't know much about the Seneca people as well. But let's start out talking about your new museum and what's going on with that. So where is this located and what's in the museum? Let's talk about that project a little bit.
The old museum, we had been there for 40 years. It was built in August 1st, 1977. And so we had a sneak peek August 4th this year. The old museum was only 10,000 square feet. We were supposed to be there for 5 years, but 40 years later, we have a new building at 33,000 square feet. My nation, the Seneca Nation, paid $18 million for it to be built. It's three times bigger than what we were currently in, so it's around 33,000 square feet. We'll hold not only the museum, but our archives, too, so it's all humidity-controlled, temperature-controlled, everything that needs to be done security-wise. In the back, we are in the process of creating a 400-seat amphitheater outside and an Indian market, and then probably not this fall, but probably in the springtime, we'll start making the longhouse, and over the next couple of years, we'll make a village based on the way we lived in the 1600s. Like I said, we still have our language. We have our own government. So, like, New York is around us. We have a president, a treasurer. We have our own court system. Actually, my wife had this last November been elected to be a court of appeals judge. So things that go into the lower courts, if somebody wants to dispute them, they can go to her court, and then those three judges will listen to the case and then decide whether or not it merits going on further or going back to the lower court. So we have our own elected system. We do government relations with the United States and with other countries. I know a couple months ago I had the French ambassador out of Buffalo come to our museum and give him a tour. And so I was happy with that, you know, just getting those kind of connections that I don't think people realize, even in our smart museum, but people from all over the world had come to it. Some people just look forward to talking with us. I think they're a little disillusioned or whatever, because, like, in the middle of our territory, we have, like, Tim Hortons and McDonald's and Burger King. And so, you know, some people, you know, they just think that we stayed in, I don't know, dressed like in the 1600s. And so, right. You know, like, well, you're not dressed like a pilgrim now, are you? And they're like, no. I'm like, yeah. People, you know, they think because I dress with blue jeans and stuff like that, that I'm not really native. I'm like, well, your shirt actually probably comes from China, but doesn't make you Chinese, does it? Like, you know, just the way I dress is not always representing who we are. We have our own traditional way of doing things. Like myself, I have long hair to show that I'm masculine. Usually when something tragic happens, then we cut our hair. the kids that went to boarding schools thought of the boys when they got their hair cut. They thought that their parents had died, that they were orphans, and that's why they were there. And later on, when they saw their parents, they were, you know, quite obviously confused as to, like, what was going on. But either the mainstream didn't realize that we had that kind of custom or didn't care at the time. But if a girl has two braids, it means that she's single. One braid means that you're married. We have a lot of different kind of customs like that. Like, we don't really point with our finger. We point with our lips. Like, you stick your lips out to say, like, it's over there and stuff.
So, really?
Yeah. You stop or whatever, pointing with your finger.
So when that fad of duck face photos was out, that was like they were all pointing at something.
Yeah.
That's wild. I feel bad because, like, the only Native American stuff I'm even vaguely familiar with is Cherokee, just because of where I live. And then the Cherokee were driven out, and I, you know, so all my experience is all about, you know, the Trail of Tears, and I feel, you know, the way Jackson screwed everybody over. I don't know. I'm filled with this mixture of ignorance and shame about the way our country has ended up here. But can you help me, like, eradicate a little bit of this? Like, where in America, like, where is the territory that was traditionally controlled by the Seneca, and what's the situation now with where do you, like, you're, it sounds like you got some autonomy, but still within the bounds of the United States. So how does that all work?
Well, that's the thing, is that like, we've given up land, but where I live in Ohio, in Allegheny, we've always owned that land. So the United States has never owned our land.
Wow.
Versus the Cherokee that were moved over to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So those are executive reservations. We're traditional homeland treaty reservations. We have treaties with the United States that are still enforceable today. And so, like, we don't pay taxes on, like, our land because we're not within the United States, and we don't have a tax system within our Seneca Nation. We use other ways to get money for the government. So we have a whole different other system of economy. Yeah, we do have casinos, but that's not always where we get all our money from.
Yeah.
And we, you know, rent land, and then we own other things, other companies.
How about the local infrastructure? Like how do the roads and stuff tie into the rest of the state?
People usually don't know until they see, like, our signs, and then there's stuff written in Indian. Actually, Ohio comes from Ohio. It's actually spelled the same way. And in our language, Ohio means a beautiful river. But that's where Ohio comes along. So when some people go through our territory and they see Ohio, they think it's Ohio. And then we have, like, Sahate, which in our language means stop. So you see the stop sign, and underneath the stop sign is, you know, Sahate. People usually get the general gist that it means to stop.
Yeah.
You know, there's different places where you'll see different Indian words, or we've had our own language department. And so, like, my wife, before she became a judge, she was in the language immersion class. So from 9 o'clock until 3 o'clock, Monday through Friday, that's all they spoke was our own language. To me, when I speak English, it's like watching a 2D movie. When I speak Indian, it's more like watching a 3D movie. We have spatial recognitions and other things that are concepts that aren't in English. Like I said, like, my name, Hawaiandi, like, the Ha means, like, I'm over there within sight. But if I was Tawaiandi, then it would be like I was out of sight. You know, whatever I'm talking about, I'm here, and that's way over there, out of sight. And so when I talk Indian, I can tell, like, how far something is to me, or how close it is, if it's up high, down low. It's really good for, like, engineering, when you're making something, because you can really tell exactly where something is, or, you know, it's to the left or to the right or something like that. So based on where you're standing. And then, unlike English, like, Hawaiian D, my Indian name, I'm the only one in this generation that has that. So there's no way to not understand, like, who you're talking to. How many Davids are in the world? I don't know, 100,000 or something, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, Hawaiian D, there's just me. And I inherited that name. Just like my wife, her name is Digiwa Nets. So it means, like, two thoughts falling, two things falling. But she inherited that name from her grandmother. Her great-grandmother was Digiwanans. And so that's how we pass on our names. It comes to the women's line. And so we have clan mothers. They're the name holders, and they're the ones that give people their name. And then like our clan system, we did our clan system because when people are new to the world, they didn't realize they weren't going to live forever. And older man dies, and then a young girl dies, and then somebody important in the community dies. That's when they realize that we're just here temporarily. So we made our clan system to actually deal with death. So if somebody dies on the animal side, then the bird side takes care of it. So like I said, I'm beaver. My wife is a great blue heron. So ours is a good marriage. Keeps the blood clean. So you don't really hear too many stories about birth defects within our stories. Every once in a while you hear a little bit, but not too much. Anybody in my clan would be considered like a brother or sister. Anybody on my side would be considered like a cousin. So that's why they get married on the other side. So then that way you're not too close.
So there's like a cultural taboo against too close to marriage?
Yeah.
Wow.
So a turtle and a turtle shouldn't get married to each other. Whether they're Seneca, Mohawk, Onondaga, doesn't matter. Like, I can go to Onondaga and there's beaver clan there, and I just consider them like my family. So if they come over and they need a place to stay, then they come and stay with me. If I need a place to stay, I stay with them. It's one of the reasons that we were able to have a confederacy. Because in our own language, we call ourselves Haudenosaunee, people of Longhouse. And so it's like we all live in one big house together.
I think the differences in ways of talking about time and space in Indigenous languages is really interesting. Certainly with American Native Indigenous languages, it's just so different. But I'm just curious about the language. Is it endangered? It sounds like there are some revitalization attempts. You were talking about your wife attending school, an immersion school. Is it endangered?
Yeah, when people went to the boarding schools, some people were stolen away from their families and put into boarding school. And so they were punished for speaking the language. So, you know, a lot of people don't realize all the trauma that they went through. But I remember on YouTube, there was a woman. She wondered how come her mother never taught her how to speak her language. And when she got older, she was investigating it. Her aunt said, well, that she had they had a brother. I guess the brother refused to speak English. And so the nun washed his mouth out with soap. And as she was washing his mouth out with soap, the soap got caught in his throat, choked him, and he died.
Wow. And
so the mother never wanted her children to be punished like that. So that's why she taught her just to speak English and not her native language. So you hear a lot of stories like that. And nowadays, it's more trying to bring back the language.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we had a similar thing in Australia too with Indigenous people. They call it the Stolen Generation. Back in the 20th century, I think in the 1950s, a lot of Aboriginal children were taken away from their parents and put in foster care with white families, and to this day have not been able to trace their biological families. So it's a very, very sad thing, very terrible thing to happen in our history, very shameful.
Yeah, that happened with the First Nations too.
Yeah, and it happened here. So, I mean, that's where some things get lost or whatever. But one of my jobs as the museum director is to make sure we connect with our culture. And so, like, one of our exhibits is about our oral history. And as time has gone on, things that they consider myth are actually now being proven to be actually true. For example, like in our language, we call a pig a boar, squish squish. And if you look at a hog, right, a boar, you know, it has a tusk, it has a snout, and every, a little bit of hair and stuff. Well, that word that we use for squish squish pig actually goes back probably about 20,000 years ago. Can you think of an animal that was looked like a pig 20,000 years ago?
With tusks? Something with a longer nose, you mean?
Yeah.
So I'm going to get in trouble here because I'll probably say the wrong one. I'm going to say mammoths, but it might be mastodons here. I can't remember. There's like,
no, it was a mammoth. That's so one of my ancestors saw the pig, the hog that the Germans and the French brought over. Because we have a story, oral history story about one time a huge grease, a mammoth came through and knocked over the palisade and knocked over people's longhouses that they lived in and caused all this trauma. And so, you know, in the 1800s, they didn't believe that there was such an animal. Through anthropology and archaeology, a couple little towns away from us, there's Randolph, New York, and they found mastodons there. And so it just collaborates with our oral history story that this isn't a myth. They were actually around and that we actually have a word in our language for them.
Yeah, so you think they were like the oral history was keeping that alive. And so when the words were already there, but when the new animal showed up, that was the closest thing. Is that
the,
yeah. Wow. No, you know, by the way, all this talk about language, I don't know if we mentioned it, but Karen's background is linguistics. So that's...
historical linguistics isn't my specialty, but I'm still interested in all of this.
But I mean, it's such an important thing. It comes up a lot. A lot of the I'm always interested
in etymology. We're talking about monsters and creatures. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, like in our language, we have Zanoskawa is like a huge blue dinosaur. And now, you know, with Jurassic Park coming out and with those raptors, it's exactly how it's described in our language. So now we know that Zanoskawa is what our ancestors called those raptors. And so I think stuff like that is neat in our language. And it shows, like, to me how old our language is, because not only do we have a word for dinosaur, but we have a word for actually a blue dinosaur.
That's pretty wild. Is there like a folklore or myths around? Before I even say that, let me back up just a second, because when I'm talking with someone who's got a cultural background far different from mine, I want to be careful about how I word my questions. So I wanted to talk to you about folklore and mythology. But it occurred to me that maybe what I'm thinking of as folklore mythology might be an active, you know, religious belief or historical factual
history,
belief.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure that what I'm talking about is the oral history of your people. But I want to make sure that we talk about it in a way that we're not dismissive of it.
So I mean, like, that's the thing, when people call it myth or folklore, you know, they're sort of dismissing it as not real.
Exactly, and that's not fair, because I have no idea how much of this is considered to be tradition, how much of this is considered to be active faith, that sort of thing. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that you asked about like our people and stuff, you know, about the Boston Tea Party and the non-natives dressed up as Indians. Mm-hmm. Do you know why they dressed up as Indians?
I don't.
No.
Because it was Elizabeth Tucker, who's an anthropologist, theorized that they were making a political statement that we had freedoms over here that they never had in Europe. And so they wanted to be Americans. They wanted to be free like we were. Because, like, under our great law of peace and stuff like that, we had autonomy that was never thought about over in Europe. That's why they got dressed as Indians.
So it was kind of like a sign of, like, rebellion, freedom, kind of the don't tread on me kind of thing?
Yeah.
Back to what I was saying, though, I guess, what is the, traditional tribal religious system, and how does folklore play into that?
We have what's called Guy Wheel, which is the great word or the good word. But to us, we have no word in our language for a religion, just a way of life. And so it's just based on how you lived your life. And so even like when I introduced myself and said, you know, Nyawis Keno, what I'm really saying in our language is, are you healthy? Are you at peace? If somebody's not at peace, they're healthy, then it's up to us as human beings to help them out to bring them back to peace.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
And so,
beautiful.
But we don't really have, we have ceremonies, we have dances and stuff like that. Some people consider that like the religion, but people that are engaged in our old ways of being just realize that every day that you're alive, you're connected to the world around you. And it's not just some special place, you know. Like my grandfather, Sherman War, used to say, like, if he wanted to pray, he didn't need to go to a building. He just went out in the woods and prayed. And, like we do, what's called the Ganonyok, the Thanksgiving address. And some people consider it a prayer, but I don't really consider it a prayer because all we're doing is giving thanks for everything in the world, from the water to the trees and to the wind. Because without them, we don't survive. And that way, I guess, you know, like I said, we don't really have a religion. It's just the most pertinent thing is Ganonkwatshet, as to show love to everybody. That was what we were taught early on. Even those stories that I was talking about, like was the Noskowa, certain men, certain people gave up their lives in order for the people to survive. Because we have like another story, it's about Dinotes, which we call a mosquito now. But the mosquito came about because of a big monster. And I always wondered about Dinotes because it translates into like it has a big beak. But I don't really think of a mosquito having a beak. I think of it like a long nose. But when you listen to like stories that come from like Corn Planter from the 1700s and so on, that when they talk about this big mosquito, the wingspan of it was 3 men long. I'm usually about the average height for an Indian, which is around 6 foot. So it's about 18 feet long, the width span. It had a long beak and a lot of teeth in it.
That's a big mosquito.
Sounds like the ones around here.
And then, like, the feet looked like they had arrows. And so when I look at that and think about it, it was like a pterodactyl kind of thing, a pterosaur bird. And so when they so a couple of the men, what they did was they tied themselves down, and then the pterodactyl tried to take them. And ended up dying. But in the meantime, while the pterodactyl was attacking the guy, the other guys were attacking the pterodactyl. Because in our beliefs, there's like monsters or dinosaurs under the world. And Hino, the thunder beings, they keep them down there. Like Hino would be like Thor, I guess, in Viking lore.
Is it a deity or like a half, like is it a hero or is it a god?
It's not really like a god or whatever. They're like we call them like our grandfathers, you know, they're entities that are older than we are. part of their helping us for humanity is to make sure that, like, these dinosaurs, like, these big monsters stay under the ground and keep us safe. And so, like, when lightning hits under the ground, it's thought that maybe those dinosaurs are coming too close to the world, and they remind them to get back down there and stay in those caves under the world.
Yeah, but are you talking about, so under the ground, is that like a hollow earth kind of thing?
I guess so. I mean, that's sort of what they talk about, is that, you know, there's when the creator and his brother, nowadays, sometimes they try to compare them like good and evil, but to me, it was more like one was more like the yin and the yang. One was positive, one was negative. And so his brother, the creator's brother, tried to create things. And one of the things he ended up creating was monsters, like dinosaurs. And it was killing people. And the creator then put them underneath the world in this big cave. So, you know, they keep them down there. We have prophecies about the thunder being is coming from the east, and there'll be a big storm. Like, there was never before a storm like this. And once that storm's gone through, they'll go away for a while. And then those big monsters will come up from under the earth, because they won't be around to keep them down. And so when I was young, people didn't think that was going to happen. But now with these tornadoes and hurricanes and all that happening in the east, on coming in more and more onto the east coast, you know, we wonder if those prophecies might happen then one day. Or maybe it's like a big hurricane or something that comes through our territory.
Does your lore have like a apocalyptic kind of predictions out there? What's that like?
The first time, you know, like humanity happened, there was a big fire and that destroyed a lot of things. And then there was the Dew Eagle that saved us. And then the next time there was ice, and that froze the world and killed a lot of people. And the last time there was a big flood. That's why in our language we're known as Anondawatga, people of the Great Hill, because there was a flood at one time and our people survived it by, had rained for, 90 days, something like that anyways. And they were on this big hill and survived it anyway. So a woman from the south comes with corn and gives them corn to eat, because at a certain point they didn't have anything to eat. They were eating the bark off from trees. When they didn't have that, then they were starving. But like I said, then the woman comes from the south, gives them corn to eat anyways. Nowadays we have a practice of saying Yahweh when we get done eating, which is giving thanks to that. But it all goes back to the one that was that major flood. And the leader at the time said that they knew what it was to be without food, so they would always be thankful for it. And so we're supposed to, in Gaiweo, there's prophecies by Handsome Lake. And it was in like 1799 that he made some of these prophecies. So some of them is that, you know, the trees will die from the top down. We see that now. And animals being born deformed wise, and see some of the chemicals and everything that's in the water with animals being deformed. Some of the diseases that they talk about is coming about anyway. Bird flu and all that, it sounds to me, was some of those prophecies. And then we'll go into like the fourth world. Some people will survive, some people won't. But that was why we have these prophecies, is to help us know that it was on the plan, I guess.
Yeah.
Or how to survive it.
I guess most prophecies do that. They give you, maybe they give you something to worry about, something to prepare for, but also give you a context, you know. So, yeah. Well, I guess we invited you on at the suggestion of Brad Lockwood, I guess. Oh, okay. And he said that you might be able to talk to us some about the monsters that sort of element within your people's stories, and so
ghost legends,
yeah, all kinds of stuff. So, you know, I guess we're limited in time, but I wanted to kind of find out a little bit about the kind of monsters that, I guess, I'd be interested in monsters that people think are literally true and monsters that people think are maybe more representative and something about how your people deal with ghosts and that kind of stuff.
Sort of like what you call like Bigfoot. We call them the stone giants, but they weren't really beings made from stone. They either their skin was sticky or they put tar on their skin and they rolled their youth in like sand and other things. And over time, they wore this like armor of a stone on them. I think you guys would call them like Bigfoot. And so they would eat people. And in one of our stories, there was a big meteor. Meteors were striking the world. Those beings were human beings at one point, but then they changed. And like I said, they had like the sticky substance to their skin. So when I was young, that's what I think more people thought of, like the stone giants as being that. But there were another being anyways that loved and, you know, had relationships, and sometimes they helped us and sometimes they caused a lot of chaos. And like for G-Scant Ghost, one of the things like in our way of being, it's sort of like, you ever watch Ghost Whisperer, the TV series?
Yeah, I think I've seen some of it.
So she likes talk to the ghosts and stuff. Mm-hmm. A lot of that story is sort of like how we believe the world is. That when the creator made us, he made us to walk on the earth and to touch the earth. And when you die, you don't touch the earth anymore. So you have to go on to another place. And so when our people die.
Sorry, just, yes, I have seen it. That's Jennifer Love Hewitt's show. Got it. Okay.
So a lot of our beliefs is like that, where, you know, people that are passed on, they can have a good or bad influence on humanity. And mm-hmm. So that's why they need to go on to wherever we came from. Because like in our way of talking about like the soul, the spirit of a human being, it's called twice hat. And so part of like on the top of your head, that soft spot, that's where the spirit from heaven comes. There's another strand. It's the physical part of this world, the earth. And then part of it too, there's another strand that's the spirit of this planet. And when those three things were combined together and the creator made people and he blew life into them, it lit a fire up. And so when death comes, it puts out that fire. And that's why people go cold and stuff. But I remember we were, I used to work in men's ceremonial before I was the director. So mm-hmm. It was part of our job to make sure our ceremonies happen the way they're supposed to. And so we were talking about the graphic novel Red Mars. No, you guys ever read that?
You like the Kim Stanley Robinson?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got the novel. You know, I haven't read the graphic novel version, but yeah.
Okay. So basically natives go to live on Mars and the corporation pollute this planet and then decided to go over there and take over that planet. But what we were discussing in anyways was Ungwe is what we call a human being. And we wondered whether or not there would be Ungwe, whether they'd be a human being. Because like I said, part of what makes us a human being is the spirit of this planet. And so if they're born on Mars, then they wouldn't be the spirit of this planet, would be the spirit of that planet. So we wondered what kind of being they would be.
That's sort of similar to some of the theories or beliefs that people have about UFOs and aliens. They're similar beliefs to that amongst the Seneca people?
Well, sort of. I mean, we have the sky beings. You know, there's the sky world. And so every once in a while, they come down. Like with Gaiweo, there were the three beings, and they're from the sky world. It's hard to say whether or not it's from like a, well, because like when we talk about when people die, they go to towns that they and tell them it's sort of like another planet or something. And one of our stories about creation, there was a sky world. When Sky Woman fell, there was a tree that was in the sky world that lit up the sky. When they pulled the tree, I always thought of it as like a cave kind of art premise. But in John Armstrong's version of our creation story, when the tree was pulled up from the sky world, there was a white light with a green light in the middle. So it sounds to me more like a wormhole kind of thing. My sci-fi guy gets it to me, and then they throw her through the hole, and she comes to this realm. Because even in like I said, we have like spatial recognitions.
Yeah.
Have in English. So like when we do the Gnonio, or like my version of the Gnonio, and Baba Janto is the word I use for the Gnonio. And it's sort of like I take a fishing hook and I throw it from this realm into the spiritual realm and pull into this realm the Thanksgiving address. And so it's sort of like different dimensions. Because like in some of all history stories, we talk about little people. And so I don't know if they're dwarves or what they are, but when you hear some of the stories about this little boy or little girl gets taken by the little people to their village, the sky is different. It's like a reddish color. The child might stay there for like 3 days, but when they come back to the village, it's like 50 years later.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So do you know how old those stories are?
No one knows how old those stories are. I mean, some of the things that we do, you know, it could be a millennia ago. It's hard to say.
But do you think they predate European contact?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
So I always just find that interesting because the stories of little people and the ideas of, like, you know, in, what in Europe would be like, you know, the fairy folk. There's so many similarities.
Yeah.
Across the world with those kind of stories.
When we talk about little people, there's three different variations of them. They're very tiny ones. And then there's other ones that are maybe like 6 feet or 6 inches tall. But then there's other little people that are like about the size of like a 2-year-old child or something. And then they have different duties. I guess they'd be interdimensional, I guess is what you would call it nowadays. Like I said, like they can come into our realm, but then be in their realm too.
We talk about that a lot in the folklore we discuss. I shouldn't say folklore either, because some people say it's stuff that's really happened to them. But ultra dimensional is one of the terms we're using a lot now. But this same.
Like the eyes to see them, or some people, because even nowadays, some people say they see them. I remember once when I was talking at University of Buffalo, we were talking about little people, and I said, well, some people are colorblind, but it doesn't mean that there's not color, you know?
Yeah.
but some people see little people and other ones don't. I don't know if it's genetics or, you know, in the blood or what, but just because not everybody sees them doesn't mean that it's not true.
So you mentioned someone had written some of these things down. If our listeners want to learn more about Seneca stories, where should they go? Like, can you recommend something that kind of...
Jesse Kornpiner, his books, Legends of the Longhouse. Arthur Parker, he's written, you know, different ones. In some of the stories, you know, we thought people had died and then they pop up and then they start eating people. So they're sort of like vampires in our stories. So even nowadays, like when we have a wake for the person, we have two men that aren't related to that person, you know, stay with them all the time, overnight and everything. So, and it just goes back to those stories about when people came back from the dead, basically. It's not sort of like the vampire, like in Dracula, but it's sort of that.
So, yeah, there's a concern that someone could come back as a vampire-like creature then and cause harm.
Yeah, and they sort of like are cannibals. They go to eat people. So.
Okay.
It's more ghoulish, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, frightening take on that. Just like the equivalent of Bigfoot eating people. That's different. I was just going to change topic a little bit because we're starting to draw to a close of our time. Just to hear a little bit more about the new museum, can you tell us a bit about some of the artifacts and the exhibits that you have there?
Well, we have right now, over the last 40 years, we have over 11,000 items in our collection. Like, we have a spot that's 800 AD, and we have different baskets, you name it. We have arrowheads and all that kind of stuff, but we have beaver. Everything that we have in our collection, we've preserved the best that we can. But now that we have the new building, it's all temperature controlled and environmentally. And so we're looking at repatriating more things. I know talked with New York State Museum. They just got back the corn planter peace pipe that was stolen over 70 years ago. They heard about our new cultural center and are looking at repatriating that back to us. And so now that we have the facilities, all the requirements, we're looking at getting a lot of things returned back to us. We made sure the building was set, so in case we wanted, like, one of our original treaties from the Estonian, that it meets all the requirements that they require.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really happy about us being able to get back things that maybe things that we didn't even know about. On the outside of the museum, we're looking at one of the statues being a trail tree. My ancestors used to bend the trees to go along with the path, and it was sort of like a destination sign. They would have certain marks on it in case they wanted water in a certain way or a spiritual site or something like that. You could just tell by looking at the tree what was in that, on that path.
Oh, it's very exciting. You're going to get some of these artifacts back. I mean, there are certainly lots of cases historically of English and German archaeologists who have stolen artifacts from Egypt and other places, and it was still on display in museums in those countries, and they haven't got them back. So that's really good news.
Yeah. And proper preservation techniques and that sort of thing to keep them around for generations to come. What does it cost to view the museum?
$9 for an adult and $5 for a kid. Any kids under 7 years old for free. Elders are $4. So, and then sometimes we have big events where we just don't have an admission. And then there's usually like the third Saturday in October, we're going to do Spooktacular Family Fun Day.
Oh, neat.
And so it's like a Halloween kind of theme, in which one of the things that we do is Long Nose. And Long Nose is more like sort of like the boogeyman. So when kids were bad, Long Nose would come and chase them and eat them.
Yeah. So yeah, Long Nose could be the booger man too. The what? So I guess we're all out of time. I feel like we just lightly scratched the surface. I mean, this there's so much here to talk about, and that we don't. I don't personally have any. Really, I mean, thank you for helping me learn a little bit about this. We'll put some links into the show notes for how to get to the museum and to these books. And if you don't mind, if you think of any other books you'd like us to link to, if you could email those to us, we'll add those to the show notes as well. And for our final question, we'd like to ask our guests, what's your favorite monster?
I guess it would be Long Nose.
All right. So tell us about Long Nose.
Good answer.
Yeah.
Like I said, like when kids were bad.
Yeah.
The men used to wear like a mask and like take him or her and chase him around during the night in the village and stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
Did that ever happen to you? Did your parents threaten you?
No, that happened to me. That was the thing, is that traditionally, because like we don't spank people or our kids, you know, we either give them water, like dunk them in water, or we use like the red whip, or we use like Long Nose. But it's hard to use Long Nose nowadays because of street lights. So
spoils the effect, right?
Yeah, it's hard to come with darkness or whatever. Usually there's street lights everywhere. So but yeah, even we have what's called the our puppet show, and we have Long Nose as one of the characters anyways in our show, and usually the non-native kids get more scared than the native kids actually with it.
I think it's really cool. Out of all the monsters in the world, Long Nose is the one you picked. But
yes, very nice pun there.
Well, David, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today and introduce me, at least, and I'm sure many of our listeners, to a little taste of your culture. That's awesome.
And congratulations on the new museum as well.
Absolutely.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you guys.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with David Shongo discussing Seneca legends and beliefs. David represents the Seneca Nation Museum in Salamanca, New York, where they just opened a large new facility with many culturally important exhibits. Find more information in our show notes at monstertalk.org. If you make it up to the museum, be sure and drop by our Facebook group and let us know how it went. Monster Talk's an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show represent the opinions of the host and the guest and may not reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms.
Save the date for a colossal PsyCon 2018. Bigger venue, bigger stars, bigger ideas, bigger fun. Las Vegas, October the 18th to the 21st, 2018. PsyCon is already one of the planet's premier skeptical conferences, where hundreds of critical thinkers come to Las Vegas, the city of illusions, to hear from the leading lights of science and skepticism. For 2018, we want PsyCon to be bigger than ever. We've even booked a bigger hotel. Come to Las Vegas at the Westgate Resort and Casino to see the brilliant and hilarious Stephen Fry on stage with Richard Dawkins. An opening night talk by Steven Pinker on the ideas behind his new book, Enlightenment Now. The triumphant return of James the Amazing Randi. Plus, New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer, psychologist and memetics expert Susan Blackmore, the Psy Babe Yvette D'Entremont, virologist and advocate for science-based medicine Paul Offit, and many, many more, along with comic musician George Rabb, serving as Master of Ceremonies, a magic show from Banachek, author book signings, and of course, a Halloween costume party. It's true. Conspiracy theorists, quacks peddling fake medicine, and the deniers of evolution, climate change, and vaccine science are bigger threats than ever. With PsyCon 2018, let's show them that they have just met their match. We'll see you in Las Vegas. For more information and to book your tickets, visit csiconference.org. That's psyconference.org.
Monster Talk theme music's by Pete Stealing Monkeys, and we really appreciate you taking the time to listen to Monster Talk and hope that you'll share the show with your friends.
for more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.